Lecture 36, Lessons from the Great Books.
We come now to the end of our course on great books, books that have made history, books that can change your life. And we ask ourselves, why read great books? We began our course, as Socrates told us we should, with definitions. How do we define a great book? Remember, you cannot get anywhere in any discussion unless you know what you're talking about. And I gave you a very clear definition. A great book has a great theme. It is written in noble language, language that elevates your soul, raises your soul to the sublime. And it speaks across the ages. A great book must speak across the ages. It has universality to it. And you see, right there, I am already loading the discussion. Because I have said that this noble language will elevate your soul. And that is perhaps something we would not all accept, that we even have a soul, much less that it can be elevated. So any discussion of great books must involve values. And I would suggest to you that you cannot read a great book and learn from it. You can read it, but you cannot learn from it unless you are willing to enter sympathetically into the mind of the author. You cannot learn from the Quran unless you are willing to enter sympathetically into the mind of Islam. You cannot read Job unless you are willing to enter sympathetically into the mind of the Hebrews and the prophets. And you cannot read and learn from Plato unless you are willing to enter into the mind that said, the soul is immortal. So great books, we have our definition, do we not? Great theme, noble language, speaks across the ages. And I'm going to tell you we have read some very great books. We have read books that have made history. We have read books like Machiavelli and his Prince that has made history. That is to say, as Lord Acton tells us, the beginning of the modern world is with Machiavelli, with his ideas, that the state has no sense of moral judgment. There is no moral dimension to politics whatsoever. And that Socrates was absolutely wrong, that Cicero was absolutely wrong. We judge the state and the men and women who lead it by categories absolutely different from that of private individuals, and that there is a complete separation from private and public morality. And that is Machiavelli. That is why Adolf Hitler kept a copy of Machiavelli beside his bed table. And Machiavelli is not the only work that tells us about the soul of a tyrant. Beowulf, Gilgamesh, the Iliad, these seemingly innocuous little books, do they not talk about ambition and the desire to leave behind a reputation that will be remembered forever, yes or no? And what great statesman does not want to leave behind that kind of reputation? So that centuries later, we still talk about a Genghis Khan. Centuries later, we will still talk about a Joseph Stalin or Adolf Hitler. How many movies and books and documentaries go back again and again to the horror of the Nazis? And isn't that just what Achilles wanted? To die young, but to leave behind a reputation that would endure forever. And what about Gilgamesh? No, he was not going to have eternal life. But this is what he had built, Uruk. And those walls were good. And men would talk about them forever. So the desire to be remembered, the ambition, the courage, a willingness to undergo and do great evils, to leave behind that reputation. That is there in some of our books, like the Gilgamesh and the Beowulf and the Iliad. Political history. In the Divine Comedy of Dante, we not only read a story of redemption, we see those ideals that led men from all over Europe, and women in some cases, children in some cases, to take the cross and go to the Holy Land and wage war. In the Divine Comedy, there is Muhammad down in hell as a sower of dissension. And the Crusades have their justification in the ideal of Dante's Divine Comedy, a story of love. But that divine love must be spread by the sword. That was the story of the Crusades. And men who believed that they were undertaking the work of God, God wills it, they cried as they took the cross. And in John Stuart Mill, in his own Liberty, we look back to the values of the founders of our country. He is the continuum of the ideas in the Declaration of Independence, the liberty of the individual. And again, as Lord Acton, our guide, tells us, the American Revolution was the only revolution in history that was fought for a principle, for an idea, liberty. And John Stuart Mill, his book on liberty, embodies those ideals that would also lead a Churchill to stand up and say, we shall never surrender. So we have read books that have made political history and continue to make it. The book of Exodus is still alive in the newspapers today. And the idea that one religion or another religion has its sanction in a holy book, and that sanction must be worked out politically and militarily, that is right there in the book of Exodus, when the children of Israel are given the holy land, as Exodus tells us. And the Quran, that magnificent work, like the book of Exodus, it not only made spiritual history, it made political history and continues to make that political history. You do not understand the Middle East. You do not understand that vast geographical and political area stretching from Afghanistan out to Morocco and all the way up to the Danube, including the Balkans, unless you know the Quran. For it is a worldview that is total and complete. And we have read books that have made spiritual history. The Gospel of Mark, the Bhagavad Gita, Hinduism, religion of more than 600 million people still today, a Gandhi who finds in that magnificent song of God a statement of the belief that truth is God and the salvation of your soul. Confucius, he is both a spiritual guide to us and a political guide that laid the foundation of more than 2,000 years of Chinese history. Now, I would say those are books that have made history. Are they books that can change your life? For they certainly embody ages long past. The Iliad is a work that embodies the values of a heroic age, an age of honor in which warfare is the greatest value you can have, an age of the duel. And how many of us today are going to go out and fight a duel? You cannot have honor, though, without a duel. You snicker at that, but it is true. The concept of honor exists truly only in a society that has the duel, like an Alexander Hamilton and an Aaron Burr who fight over the question of honor. So that is so outmoded. Can the Iliad still speak to you today? Again, the age of Dante, the age of a belief that your whole life is but a preparation for death. We saw Socrates tell us that in the Phaedo. Is that how you live your life, as though your whole life is but a preparation for death? Just the opposite. Our whole life is spent trying to avoid death, to live as long as we can or to come back from it. So, with such an alien set of values, let's take Goethe. Goethe in his Faust. He is deeply concerned with the question of, are there absolute standards of beauty? That is something that just doesn't engage us today. We accept that each individual has some standards of beauty, that I don't like those paintings, and I know what I like. I don't know anything about art, and that's how we accept it. And, well, I don't know if our highways are ugly. They have all these fast food places, but, you know, well, they get the job done. I would rather not have a beautiful building and have a fast food place where I could pull in and have a little hamburger or taco. So we just don't worry about beauty. But to Goethe, everyone must come to terms, if they're thoughtful, with the concept of beauty. And nature? Well, we have a great deal of political discussion about nature and the environment. But Walden, Henry David Thoreau, he is so extraordinarily eccentric. How can we really enter into the values of someone who leaves everything behind and goes off and just lives in a cabin and tells us, do not look at our email. He says, don't get your postage, but don't look at your email. We're just not going to do that. So are these values so far removed from us that even though these books have made history, they cannot change our lives today? Well, we know at the outset that's wrong. They do change lives. The Quran certainly changes lives every day, winning converts for Islam. The Book of Mark still speaks and changes people's lives. We know about that. The Bhagavad Gita is still read and changes life all through the Indian world and the subcontinent and other places where Indians have gone. So these spiritual books certainly can still speak to us. But what about a Cicero on duties, on moral obligations? What makes them a great book? And can they still speak to us? Can they still educate us? Well, let's go back to our ideal of a great book. How are we so confident in saying that a great book has a great theme, is written in noble language, and speaks across the ages, has a universality to it? One of the first to grapple with the question of what makes a great book is Aristotle. He died in 322. He was the tutor of Alexander the Great and the pupil of Plato. If Plato was an intellectual and Socrates a searcher after the truth, Aristotle was a professor, very interested in science, very interested in observations of the natural world, observations of politics, interested in empirical evidence. So a very hard-headed thinker. And yet in his book on Poetics, which has been called perhaps the only work of literary criticism that is absolutely indispensable, that work that gave us our definition of a tragedy when we looked at the Oresteia or the Bacchae, Aristotle says that we judge a great book by its moral impact. A great book is a book that arouses in you moral feelings, and they should be good feelings. Ultimately, feelings that lead you to wisdom. Thus, a tragedy arouses in you the feelings of fear and pity. These are necessary emotions, and thereby achieves that purging, that catharsis of fear and pity. So a great book for Aristotle is one that has a moral impact upon you. So once again, if we're going to talk about great books, we cannot separate the question of morality from them. And Leon Tolstoy, the author of War and Peace, of Anna Karenina, whose book on the kingdom of God is within you, so touched Gandhi, left us one of the most remarkable works on what makes a great book. Again, it is a book that scholars pay little attention to. They will send you to read the War and Peace. But for Tolstoy, it was the justification of his entire life. What is art, it is called. What is art? And Tolstoy says, we judge a great book not only by the feelings it arouses in you, but the quality of those feelings. A great book, art, painting as well, a sculpture as well, architecture as well, must arouse in you good feelings. It must create a good morality. Thus, by definition, to take the most obvious example, written after Tolstoy, of course, Mein Kampf. That is an evil book. It is evil because it appeals to all that is evil in human emotions. So it is evil. But, says Tolstoy, take a work like Dostoevsky, Notes from the Underground, a precursor of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, written about the soul in prison. That is a horrifying book to read, but it rouses in you the good feeling that even amidst terror and torture and suffering, what is good in men and women lives on. That's why it is noble, Tolstoy tells us. Then there is a work like Goethe's Faust, Tolstoy says. Now, I believe it's a good book. I believe it's a great book. But Tolstoy says it is not a great book because it is too complicated for ordinary people to read. It is too much a product of its time, too filled with allusions about Greek and Roman mythology, too full of philosophical allusions. And so a book like it, or the Divine Comedy today, or Virgil's Aeneid, if they are so complicated that you spend all of your time trying to understand what the author is saying, then the emotions cannot speak to you. I would disagree there. I think there are books like the Aeneid, like the Divine Comedy, like Goethe's Faust, that are worth the struggle. They are worth finding out, first, what does the author mean by this mythological reference? Who was Forkes, for example? But once you do this, they are soul-elevating works. And that is why it is worth going back to the Gilgamesh with its complicated references to Mesopotamian religion, or why it is worth wading through the Iliad, because we see in them these simple passages, like when dawn broke forth with her rosy fingers. You don't need any mythological allusions to understand there. Homer is speaking directly to you from the heart about the beauty of every day. Like Thoreau, the sun is a morning star. So if a book is too complicated, don't let that put you off. Go into it and read it and study it and think about it. But for both Aristotle and for Tolstoy and for me, a great book must arouse in you good moral feelings. Now, you ask, whose morality? Wasn't that the question at the beginning of our course? That is the question whenever we began to talk about teaching morality in the schools. Whose morality? And it has been the lesson of this course and the books that we have read that there is a universal set of values that we find throughout these great books. Now, I do not say that as a dogmatic statement. I say it simply as an empirical one that we have taken from this course. Did we look at books from China? Confucius. Did we look at the Bhagavad Gita from India? Did we look at works from the Middle Ages? Did we look at them from classical Greece, from the Christian Middle Ages, and from the pagan classical Greece? Did we look at the Quran? And do we look at a work even like 1984, in which we see that there are a common set of values that were already defined by Socrates? What are they? Wisdom, justice, courage, and moderation. We found that for Confucius, these were the linchpin of human society. Justice, or as he called it, benevolence. Courage. The wisdom that you strive for. Remember, he said, Confucius, I have never met a wise man. I wish I could. But what I am happy to meet from time to time is a good man. Somebody who practices justice, moderation, and courage. And there in the Quran, we are called to justice, moderation, and courage. And we are told in the Quran, along with the book of Exodus, or with Job, that fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So in some of our great books, we have found wisdom linked directly to a belief in God. But Cicero, though he understands that natural law must be founded in God, nonetheless describes his entire moral approach to life, his way to live your life, what he tells his son, in pure practical terms. If you practice justice, moderation, and courage based on wisdom, then you will be successful. And you will understand that no successful person ever does anything that is morally wrong. So some of our books teach us that without a belief in God, you can still have a belief in morality and practice a moral life. So we may not want to accept this universal set of values, but one of the things we come away from in reading the great books is that such a set of values exist. How then do these books touch our lives? They will only touch our lives if we are willing to use the wisdom that comes from them in order to live our lives. And that wisdom is broader than just any set of values. That wisdom is an education for freedom. And ultimately, that's what these great books are. They educate us to live our lives in a free and responsible way. It is a question for me. I think it should be a question for you as well. what role does reading even play in today's society? I mean, we have far more effective ways of reaching people. A movie, a video game has an impact upon the mind far more attractive and compelling than a book today. In fact, we might very well deal, as I'm afraid our schools have not yet, with the possibility that we have reached an age radically different from the last 5,000 years. We told ourselves, I told you, that around 3,000 BC, civilization began in Egypt and Mesopotamia, and it began with the invention of writing. And that transformed the mind, because knowledge could now be stored and transmitted in a vastly different fashion than before, when everything relied upon memory. Well, I would suggest to you that the last 25 years have seen, in our terms of our technology, exactly such a radical transformation, in which the printed word in a book has been replaced by whatever appears on a computer screen, and even far more by what appears on a video game or through movies. And that this could absolutely transform the very character of education. So will we, 100 years from now, still read these great books? And will they still have a message to speak to us? What do I mean when I tell you that a book like that is an education for freedom? How do I define education? What did we say education was? Educo, to lead out from yourself. An education is a three-stage process, and it begins with information. It begins with collecting a lot of facts and data, just what you find on the internet every day. In fact, we live in a world in which we are so overwhelmed by facts and data that we have barely time to think. And the data becomes so overwhelming that it is difficult to take the next step, which is to weave this into knowledge. What is knowledge? Knowledge is what you ought to take away from a good teaching company course. It's an ability to see the pattern in a particular subject. But there is a third step, and that is taking that pattern and living your life by it, applying it. And that is what Socrates, and that is what Cicero, and that is what Dante, and that is what Goethe all meant by wisdom. And wisdom is ultimately an act of meditation. You only come to wisdom by being able to sit down by yourself and think about all this material. That is why for the Middle Ages, the contemplative life, the meditative life, was the supreme life. And the monk cut himself off from all human society so that the mind could be devoted entirely to the contemplation of God. That is why in the Bhagavad Gita, the highest form is those who absolutely devote themselves just to meditation. And that is still alive in India today. And Gandhi talks about those who have the freedom just to cut themselves off from all human ties to meditate as a way to achieve wisdom. So meditation is essential to transforming knowledge into wisdom. And it is just such an ability and the time to sit down and meditate that we do not have today. And that is what a great book is all about. It is not reading it in a hurry, digesting it for a class. It is sitting down with that book and allowing it to speak to you. And it'll only speak to you if you absolutely open up your mind. And that can come only through this meditation. That is the final step to wisdom. And that wisdom is ultimately a source of freedom. That is why, as long as people read great books, as long as they can sit down and take this book in their hand and contemplate it on their own, they will have these insights that lead them to freedom. But there's a danger. And Alexander Solzhenitsyn pointed it out to us in the work he, in the speech he gave at Harvard at his commencement address, in which he talks about, you now have such a wealth of information, such a wealth of books that flood you, that you are in danger of losing the truth. In other words, you are so surrounded with what comes out through the through journalists, let us say, so overwhelmed with all of that, that you are under the illusion of knowing what is going on. And you are under the illusion when you go to a bookstore and see the shelves filled with works of history, with works of classics, that you have everything at your disposal. But there might be, Solzhenitsyn says, out there somewhere, uncovered by the media, unpublished by a major publishing house, some thinker. He says, from time to time, I get a letter, sometimes from professors of in little liberal arts colleges way out in your Midwest. And I see there a person who has ideas that could save your country. But they'll never be heard of because the media doesn't pick them up. Major publishing houses don't pick them up. And there, too, is a lesson from our great books. There have been great books that have been written, authors that have been absolutely ignored, and have lain there for centuries until time and values were willing to scoop them back up. Thoreau is an interesting indication of that. His Walden created very little stir when it was published. In fact, it made no money whatsoever. It would take 100 years before society was able to pick it up and to read in that love of nature a challenge to our own destruction of the environment. Or take Gandhi. Now, yes, he was a well-known figure, but it would be in a black theological seminary, or in a theological seminary where blacks were allowed to attend, I want to say, not in the South, but in the North, that Martin Luther King would first learn about Gandhi, take that book in his hand, and see that Gandhi's steadfastness in the truth, his satyagraha, was a key to overthrowing an evil system that had paralyzed the moral fiber of his country. And it was a Martin Luther King, like a Gandhi, like a Solzhenitsyn, who had the justice, this ingrained sense of what is right, had the moral fortitude, and had the moderation that comes out of wisdom to transform society. Now you too can change your lives in small ways or in grand ways, as long as you accept the most fundamental premise that life is all about you as an individual, your willingness always to learn, your willingness to make mistakes, admit those mistakes, redeem yourself, not in a theological sense, but in an individual sense, and never to give up. And that's the ultimate lesson of these great books. Never give up. Live your life and realize that every day, just as Thoreau told you and just as Homer tells you, every day you can begin again. That is why I find the first book of the Iliad, with which we began our course, one of the most noble statements of what a great book is about. There is Zeus, with all the problems and cares, going back home, having a meal, spending time with his wife, and taking a long rest and sleep, knowing that the next day will be a chance even for a god to begin all over again.
We genuinely hope you've enjoyed these lectures from our Great Courses series. Our courses are available to order online. Visit our website at www.teachone2.com or call our customer care representatives at 1-800-TEACH-1-2. That's 1-800-TEACH-1-2. Thank you very much.